since I want to be able to see the screen. Make sure that Brother Bomberger isn't putting the slides on backwards or upside down or something. Never know what he's going to do next, do you? One announcement that wasn't made, I'd like to say just one brief word about Emmaus. The Emmaus Bible School has a correspondence school that stretches around the world. It is my privilege to be the director of the correspondence school. We have 160 regional directors using the Emmaus courses in about 90 different countries and 115 different languages. The school was started after the Second World War. To date, about 6 million people around the world have taken Emmaus courses. Every day, we enroll 1,000 people in the Emmaus Bible study program worldwide. The only reason I mention that is because we have started in the United States setting up domestic regional directors to take care of various states in the Union and various provinces of Canada. This is a new venture to match our overseas method of distribution. We have with us this evening Mr. Elmer Lloyd, who is representing the Emmaus Correspondence School in the state of Georgia. And he has kindly consented to be with us for a few days during these meetings, and he will be handling the Emmaus courses in the back for anybody who might be interested in pursuing some home Bible study in the privacy of their own homes. Shall we turn, please, to Matthew chapter 24? Verse 3. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 3. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world, or the consummation of the age? Verse 32. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When its branch is yet tender, and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Now if somebody would kindly turn out the lights and turn on the projector, we'll get down to a study this evening of the rebirth of the state of Israel and its significance for us today.
Mr. Sutton, will you please turn out the light? Thank you.
It is 1897. A voice rings out in the councils of Europe, the voice of an Austrian Jew, Theodor Herzl by name. There is a land without a people, he cries. There is a people without a land. Give the land without a people to the people without a land. This evening we are going to see how it all happens. How the Jew demanded the land, how he has defended the land, and how he is developing the land. So, back to 1897. Dr. Herzl has written a book entitled Judenstaat, the Jewish State. It's a clarion call for the rebirth of the State of Israel. It stirs the Jewish people from one end of the earth to the other. Dr. Herzl may be mad, but he simply cannot be ignored. Once more, It is 1897. Theodor Herzl has convened a congress in Switzerland, and the World Zionist Organization is born. It makes articulate the millennial hopes of the Jew. Dr. Herzl tells that first congress that the Jewish state will rise in 50 years. He erred, it turned out, by only 9 months. Slowly, Herzl's dream took shape. Jews began to emigrate to Palestine. In the early years, they came from Russia. They began to develop communal living, and the kibbutzim were born, settlements where Jews had all things in common, and where those with nothing could settle on the land. Then came World War I, and a major change in the story. Britain's back was to the wall, and her whole future was imperiled. There was no more cordite in the country for the manufacture of gunpowder. The Prime Minister, Lloyd George, appealed to young Dr. Chaim Weizmann, a renowned Jewish chemist, for aid. Dr. Weizmann found a way to manufacture a synthetic substance from horse chestnuts. A grateful government in London asked Weizmann to name his own reward. Being an ardent Zionist, he asked for British help in establishing a national home for the Jew in Palestine. The British government at once issued a famous document known as the Balfour Declaration, in which it espoused the Jewish cause. His Majesty's government so ran the famous deed, view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best efforts to facilitate the attainment of this object. On December 9, 1917, General Allenby led British troops into Jerusalem, freeing Palestine from the rule of the Turks. On May 24, 1920, the League of Nations officially ratified Britain's mandate over Palestine and endorsed the right and liberty of Jews the world over to go there and build a national home. Lloyd George appointed Herbert Samuel, a Jew, to be the civil administrator of Palestine with direct responsibility to the British cabinet. One remembers the words of Isaiah. Surely, he said, the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring thy sons from far. And the sons of strangers shall build up thy walls, and their kings shall minister unto thee. And so the Jews began to return. It was not the pull of Zion alone that brought them back to the land. A succession of anti-Semitic rulers in Eastern and Central Europe gave the big incentive. Had they not cracked the whip, there would be no state of Israel today. These harried Jews from Europe came to Palestine with just one common goal: to build and create a society where being a Jew would be no problem. But the rising tide of immigration began to cause trouble for Britain. The Arabs revolted. Acts of terrorism began to escalate. And so the British government issued what it called a white paper, which restricted further Jewish immigration into Palestine. The Jews responded by developing a number of underground groups of their own to infiltrate immigrants into the country by stealth and to sabotage the British occupation. How successful they were is shown by the fact that after Palestine became independent in 1948, of the 650,000 Jews who were in the country, no less than 113,000 were illegal immigrants. By now, however, another voice was making its strident impact on the nations of the world. The voice of one Adolf Schickelgruber, otherwise known to posterity as Adolf Hitler. In his book Mein Kampf, Hitler tells of his growing hatred for the Jew. Wherever I went, he wrote, I began to see Jews. Gradually, I began to hate them. He hated them to the very end. His last testament, written a few hours before his death, contained a final blast against the Jews as being responsible for the war which he had started. Hitler's hatred infected all of Germany. Mad tirades against the Jew were part of the general rhetoric of the Nazi world. Dr. Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda chief, preached to the world the Nazi philosophy of hatred for the Jew. Then Hitler decided on what he called the final solution to the Jewish problem. It was genocide, the systematic extermination of a race. The Jews were to be eradicated from Germany, from Europe, ultimately from the world. Mass murder became a state industry. 6 million Jews perished in the gas ovens of the Third Reich and in the slave labor camps. And so another ancient prophecy came to life. I will send for many fishers, saith the Lord, and they shall fish them. And after that, I will send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them, from every mountain and from every hill and out of the holes of the rocks. With the end of World War II, terrorist activity in Palestine began to escalate, instigated both by the Arabs and the Jews. The Arabs wanted an end to Zionism. The Jews wanted an open door for immigration and political independence from Britain. Caught between a desire to placate the Arabs and keep her hands on Arab oil and her obligations to the Jew under the mandate, Britain found herself in a difficult position. She finally washed her hands of the whole affair and turned the Palestine problem over to the United Nations. The 6,000-year-old case of the Jewish people was placed before the conscience of man in New York on Wednesday, November the 27th, 1947. It was to be decided whether or not Palestine should be partitioned between Arab and Jew. The Jewish delegation to the United Nations had little hope for success. To win partition, a two-thirds majority was needed. That meant, of course, that the Jews needed 22 votes just to offset the 11 members of the Arab-Muslim bloc. The blessing of both Russia and the United States was needed if the vote for partition was to pass. But these two countries had never voted on an issue before together. The Arabs used every possible technique to browbeat the smaller nations. Britain, disgruntled over Jewish terrorism in Palestine, vowed to vote against partition, and France, with rumblings in Algeria, prepared also to abandon Israel. And then came a switch that rocked the world, for Russia changed sides. The Russian Revolution, you will remember, had broken out just 5 days after the Balfour Declaration had been issued in 1917. Since the Balfour Declaration was British, the Russians regarded Zionism as a tool of British imperialism. They outlawed the movement, banned its adherence to Siberia, and banned the study of Hebrew. However, the Kremlin suddenly changed its tactics in 1947 and announced itself in favor of the partition of Palestine. Of course, it was just a shrewd political maneuver. The Russians were seeking a foothold in the Middle East. At that time, the Arabs had little sympathy with communism. Many, in fact, had been Nazi sympathizers. And so the Russians saw the Jews in Palestine as an instrument to push the British out of the country and ease themselves into the area in Britain's place. Moreover, the Russians wished to brand the British as tyrants. A Russian vote for Israel would force America to do the same, a move which would drive a wedge between the Anglo-Saxon powers. Russia could gain propaganda mileage from a humanitarian pose. And in addition, the Russians hoped to alienate the Jewish state from the United States. And so inadvertently the Jews suddenly found themselves with an unexpected ally. The vote in the United Nations was dramatic indeed, with the issue hanging in the balance almost to the very end. Afghanistan, the first country to vote, voted against partition. Argentina, the second country, voted to abstain. Australia, the third country, voted for partition. One by one, the countries of the British Commonwealth parted company with Britain. France, at the last moment, changed its mind and voted for partition. For the first time in history, Russia and the United States voted together in favor of a resolution. A white-faced British delegate, at the very last moment, voted to abstain. And so the day was won. The world had again agreed that the Jews must have a home. The Star of David had risen indeed. But the Arabs were enraged. Perish Judea arose like thunder on Arab lips. On May 14, the British High Commissioner for Palestine left the country. The same day, the General Zionist Council of Tel Aviv proclaimed the establishment of the Jewish state to be called Israel. David Ben-Gurion was appointed Prime Minister, and 2 days later, Chaim Weizmann was elected President. Meanwhile, the Arab world was girding for war. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who spoke for the Muslim world, appealed to the Muslim devout. "I declare," he cried, "I declare a holy war, my Muslim brothers. Murder the Jews. Murder the Jews." The Jews had successfully demanded their land. Now they must defend their land. The Jews had 4,000 or 5,000 irregular troops and a paper army of 50,000 in the Haganah. They had only 10,000 rifles and no artillery. Their air force consisted of 3 Piper Cubs. Their navy was made up of 6 old tubs used to run the British blockade and tied up in the port of Haifa. The Jews were outnumbered in soldiers 40-1. In population, 100-1, in equipment, 1,000-1, and in land mass, 5,000-1. But the Jews had something the Arabs didn't have. They were united, they were desperate, they were determined to win. Moreover, although many didn't believe it, they had God. Also, they had the Haganah, an underground army with bases and farms in the kibbutzim around the country. It was these armed outposts and these determined men who saved Israel in 1948 when the British withdrew and 3 Arab kings and a president sent their regular armies across the borders to join the Palestine guerrillas already trying to crush the newborn state. The Arabs were confident that they would win. How could they lose? But they did. The Jews, to the astonishment of the world, First, then the inrush of the Arab tide. Then they went on the offensive after a brief truce and flung the Arabs back and back until the Arabs screamed for a truce and then turned on each other in mutual recrimination and blame. The Jewish War of Liberation was won. In 1956, the Jews had to gird for another round of war with their Arab neighbors. Arab terrorists were infiltrating Israel. Egypt was joining hands with other Arab states. She was rearming. She had seized the Suez Canal. At the end of October in that year, the Jews burst out of the encircling ring. This time, they were not alone. France and Britain joined them. But the United States, irritated by this independent action, joined with Russia in demanding an end to the action. The result for Israel, however, was a little more elbow room. The result for the world was the increasing Soviet penetration of the entire Middle East. The decade between 1957 and 1967 was the most fruitful in modern Jewish history. The country grew in population, economic strength, technical power, and international standing. The Arab threat to destroy her was losing credibility. The frustrated Arabs decided to try again. The pot began to boil when Syria stepped up harassment of Israel. Egypt, armed to the teeth with Russian weapons, was sure that she could win this time. The Western powers remained strangely non-committal. Jordan joined hands with Egypt. Iraq joined the hunt. On June 4, troops from Algeria, Morocco, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia began to converge for the kill. The United Nations beat a hasty retreat from Sinai. An air of doom hovered over Israel. But once again, Israel had an asset. Israel had Moshe Dayan. They had another asset too, one that they had forgotten. Jews in other lands. Deserted by all her friends, Israel found forgotten allies in the Jews of the dispersion, who began to besiege Israeli embassies around the world for passage to Israel. Funds began to pour in too, from the Jewish Brotherhood abroad. It took the Jews just 6 days to settle accounts. Jordan was flung back across the river. Egypt was thrown back across the canal. Syria lost the Golan Heights. With victorious Israeli tanks reaching for Damascus, Amman, and the Suez, the Arabs called it quits and began to count up what they had lost. Enormous amounts of war equipment, including sophisticated Russian missiles, fell intact into Israeli hands. Egypt lost the Gaza Strip and Sinai. Syria lost the heights over Galilee. Jordan lost her holdings on the west bank of the river. Worst of all, she lost Jerusalem. When a Jew prays anywhere in the world, he faces Jerusalem. Synagogues are positioned so that worshippers face Jerusalem. In Jerusalem itself, they face the Wailing Wall. The liturgies of Yom Kippur and Passover conclude with the chant, "Next year, Jerusalem." The loss of Jerusalem was a severe blow to the Arabs and a tremendous boost to the Jews. But the most crushing blow for the Arabs was the loss of the Dome of the Rock, the Mosque of Omar, one of the holiest shrines of Islam. Jubilant, Israeli troops swarmed over the area waving Israeli and captured Arab flags. Standing as it does on the site of Solomon's temple, the Dome of the Rock is precisely where devout Jews expect that the third temple will be built. Throughout the world, Orthodox Jews face Jerusalem three times a day and say, "May it be thy will, O Lord our God, and the God of our fathers, that the temple may be speedily rebuilt in our day." So far, the Jews have successfully defended their land. They have built a fighting machine the Arabs dread. All men over 18 and a good percentage of the women are pressed into the Israeli armed forces. The religious Jews don't like to see women in the armed forces, and they turn their backs when the women march by. In Israel, one has to be a mental or a physical wreck to escape the draft. Exemption from the service is a stigma. Israel is the only country in the world with compulsory military service for women in peacetime. Training for Israeli troops is tough. The emphasis is on close combat and night fighting, the kinds of warfare the Arabs dislike the most. All officers come up through the ranks. They lead by example more than command. The term forward has been expunged from the Israeli military vocabulary and has been replaced with the term follow me. All officers are trained as commandos. If they don't qualify as commandos or paratroops, they don't qualify to lead ordinary troops. The cockiness, brazenness, improvisation and ingenuity that personify the Israeli soldier were displayed recently by an Israeli colonel in an encounter with American brass. He was a helicopter pilot out over the Mediterranean. His fuel was running low when he saw units of the U.S. 6th Fleet, including an aircraft carrier. He joined a group of U.S. helicopters which were landing on the deck of the carrier, and he hovered over the carrier until the flagman waved him down. He was summoned to the bridge, where an angry captain bawled, "Who are you?" "An Israeli pilot," the colonel said. "How dare you land on an American ship?" "Excuse me," the Israeli answered. "From above, it looked like one of ours." Israel doesn't have much faith in the pledges and promises of even the most friendly Gentile powers. She's determined never again to be dependent on foreign arms for survival, and is developing her own arms and aircraft industry. She is forging ahead in all fields of industry, farming, science, culture, finance. For having successfully demanded the land and defended the land, she is also successfully developing the land. When Dr. Herzl's voice first rang out, there were only 18 Jewish agricultural villages in Palestine. These were founded mostly by refugees from European persecution. These Jews were incompetent farmers. But they had one powerful friend, Baron Edmund de Rothschild of France. This millionaire took the settlements under his wing. He sent them experts who told the settlers to stop copying the Arab farmers. He told them to stop growing grain and plant vineyards instead. He encouraged them also to cultivate citrus, olives, and almonds for the markets of the world. Today, every fifth or sixth Jew is a citizen of the Jewish state. The whole thing developed practically from nothing. Just before the turn of this century, there were only 50,000 Jews in Palestine and they weren't even an integrated society. Mostly, they dedicated themselves to God, praying for the coming of the Messiah and for the ingathering of the exiles. The Jews in the dispersion, who yearned for the same miracle, piously dropped their pennies into collection boxes to support their brethren in Palestine. They regarded the Palestinian Jews as a religious elite who maintained a foothold on the holy soil for the coming of the Messiah. In Palestine, there were also small pockets of worldly Jews, regarded by the pious as heretics. They'd come from Europe and Russia as refugees, and they were really Israel's Mayflower pilgrims. These were the Jews who began to rejuvenate the land and lay the foundations for much of modern Israel. Manual labor was their ideology. The heroes of that era were the callous-handed, dry-haired, prematurely wizened former students who contracted malaria draining infested marshes, or who broke their backs clearing away rocks to reclaim long neglected soil for Jewish farming. They founded cohesive communities, the kibbutzim, which were ideal bases for training Haganah units, stocking secret arms, hiding immigrants smuggled into the country, and for other clandestine activities in the long struggle for statehood after the British mandate broke down. As these kibbutzim, the communal farms, prospered, the living codes changed. When nobody had had anything in the early days, equality had been complete and rigid. Privacy had been taboo. If a member received a fountain pen or a radio from a relative, he turned it over to the commune to be shared. Even clothing was pooled. But as the economy improved, those rules were relaxed. Nevertheless, the settlements had tried to keep up their egalitarian social structure. The brilliant chemist or engineer, who may be a key man today in a million-dollar factory, has the same rights in the kibbutz as the least skilled member. From time to time, his name appears on the work roster for a stint as a field hand or a waiter, not because his labor is needed, but to symbolize the equality of the commune. The kibbutzim have always been represented in positions of power in Israel out of proportion to their numbers. They're the closest thing in the country to an aristocracy. In the ruling Labour Party, never to have been a member of a kibbutz is something of a political handicap. The movement has provided an extraordinary amount of leadership in the armed forces. Kibbutz rules are conspicuous among officers in combat units and as Air Force pilots. There's something about their grooming that makes them instinctive volunteers. The native-born Palestinian proudly takes the title of Sabra. The term Sabra is an Arabic word for the fruit of the cactus plant. The Jewish Sabra believes he has been so called because the cactus is prickly and tough on the outside, but soft and sweet on the inside. Like Jews everywhere, the Sabras in Palestine were deeply affected by the Nazi Holocaust, but they were affected in a uniquely Sabra way. It wasn't so much what the Nazis had done that they couldn't shake off. It was the vision of an endless pile of Jews shuffling with sheep-like docility to their doom. The Sabras couldn't understand why the victims hadn't lashed out and gone down fighting. The helplessness of the world to prevent the slaughter taught the Sabras another lesson. In a crunch, they could rely only on themselves. It was this which drove them to such incredible victories in 1948, in 1956, and in 1967. In 1948, the Jewish state was born. Then came the flood tide of immigration, which had dried up to a mere trickle during the closing days of British rule. Minutes after Israel was proclaimed a sovereign state, all British legislation restricting immigration for Jews to Palestine was erased from the statute books. Shiploads of immigrants were on the high seas. And the Friday afternoon, the state was being proclaimed. From Hitler's death camps they came, from British internment in Cyprus, and from hostile Arab and communist lands, from Bulgaria, Romania, and Czechoslovakia and Poland, from Yemen, Turkey, and Iran, white faces, black faces, and brown, Jews from scores of lands, from the cultured West and from the romantic East, Jews of every sort, religious Jews, agnostic Jews, Jews with doctor's degrees, and Jews who could scarcely read. It brought to light Isaiah's words, "And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time, to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, and from Egypt, and from Pathros, and from Cush, and from Elam, and from Shinar, and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." Immigrants from tropical countries, for example, had never seen snow. The Yemenites, descending from the plains, when they saw the ground covered with a mysterious white substance, thought God had performed one of his former miracles. "Manna," they exclaimed. "Manna." These Yemenite Jews were religiously devout, and they were literate too. The menfolk of the community could read the Bible. They could even read it upside down and from the sides. This peculiar accomplishment stemmed from the shortage of Bibles in their corner of the world. Classes studied the Bible in circles, the students squatting around the few available books. So they literally learned to study the Bible from all angles. They believed in miracles too, and little wonder, for strange men had appeared in their midst, had ferreted them out of the slums and caves, and shepherded them to the airfields, and then they were borne to Palestine on the wings of an eagle, as the ancient Hebrew prophets had foretold, flying high above the hills. The tremendous influx of Jews from such diverse backgrounds created numerous economic problems. It created social problems too. But gradually the state coped with things, and vast changes took place in every phase of national life. During the years for struggle for recognition and independence, the main center of national power was the Jewish Agency, the executive arm of the World Zionist Organization. The Jerusalem section was a kind of shadow cabinet of the embryonic Jewish state. When the state came into being, the key Palestinian members became the core of the provisional government. Now, Israel is a democracy patterned along British lines. The power of Parliament is supreme. The presidency, like the British monarchy, is a ceremonial and decorative office only. The presidency was offered first to Professor Albert Einstein, who had long been a supporter of the Zionist cause. The thought was that the presidency of Israel should go to the greatest Jew in the world, not necessarily to an Israeli. However, Einstein declined the position. The first incumbent was instead Dr. Chaim Weizmann, who had for many years been the towering figure behind the Zionist movement and its revered champion. Millions of Jews had perished during the Nazi reign of terror in Europe. The world has largely forgotten that disaster. But in their home city of Kaskar, the names and dates of Czech Jews murdered by the Nazis are listed on a mourning scroll. In Israel, they have a more meaningful memorial. They have the Forest of the Martyrs, containing 6 million trees, as a living tribute to the dead. Other forests have been planted too, the Balfour Forest and the Great Herzl Forest, for example. More trees mean more shade, more oxygen, more moisture in the soil, more organic matter on the surface, more raw materials for factories and farms. The most spectacular changes have come in the face of the land, which hard work and technical skill have transformed. The desert is literally beginning to blossom as the rose. In the Negev, the changes are startling. The Negev's eastern frontier is the Araba Depression. There isn't a drop of water in 110 miles between the sea and the Gulf. Rainfall is non-existent, as a rule, and when it does come, it produces freak floods which rage down from the hills with destructive force. The Israelis have exploited this forbidding area, seeing it as a God-given hothouse. Their first success was in the planting of dates. Dates, argued the Jews, sustain the Arabs in the desert. Why not grow dates in the Araba? The dates they coveted were a special variety which grew only in Iraq, on the Persian Gulf. Now, date-producing countries jealously guard their seedlings. The idea of getting some from a member of the Arab League was wild. But the Israelis managed to trick the Iraqis into exporting some seedlings, supposedly destined for Italy, but actually intended for Israel. And now, thousands upon thousands of these palm trees flourish in the Araba Depression. Many in Israel, even in the armed forces, are rigidly Orthodox. The Orthodox establishment wields tremendous influence in Israel, out of all proportion to its size. It is a very power in the land. It is insensitive to the resentment of non-Orthodox Jews who suffer as a result of the rigid enforcement of ancient laws. The Orthodox establishment would rather outrage public opinion than run the risk of irking the Almighty. Attempts to coerce the non-religious lead to considerable friction. For employing a Jew on the Sabbath, or on the 8 biblical festival days, a person can be sent to jail. Laws and regulations imposing Sabbath restrictions are rigidly enforced. Most means of transportation are banned on the Sabbath. One can see the force of the Lord's words, "Pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath day," as he spoke concerning the great tribulation. Apostates in Israel are regarded with revulsion. The family of one who abandons Judaism tears its garments and sits on the ground in mourning as though he had actually died. It's not a sin in Israel to be irreligious. For that doesn't sever